Welcome to Here We Stand, the voice of the resistance, the voice of the republic, the voice that never sounds in slavery. I'm your host, Kevin Annett, Eagle Strong Voice. It's August 16th. Welcome to all new listeners and old listeners, especially to a wonderful group of people who I spoke with this week in Denmark, who are setting up a common law court based on our work, our book, Common Law Training Manual and the Whistleblower's Manual. They're taking them to heart and also trying to set up groups in Sweden and Russia based on our work. So this movement of freedom is spreading around the world, people. We're here every Sunday at 3 p.m. We are the voice of the resistance and the growing network of resistance. It's a show where we put knowledge in your mind, fire in your heart, and iron in your guts, because we are in a fight to the death, people. Recent information given to us shows that there is a definite plan in Canada and likely elsewhere to set up quarantine centers in the schools in the next 2 to 3 weeks, so that when schools resume, children will literally be quarantined. And to see your children again, you have to agree to mandatory vaccination. That's clearly the work. We know what's in the works because a company called SNC-Lavalin in Canada, which was implicated in giving bribes to the Trudeau government, they're the ones building some of these facilities, at least in British Columbia. So we are going to equip people today with how you fight that, especially parents on the ground. Keep your children out of the schools, out of the daycares, especially. Follow our work, Republic of Kanata, K-A-N-A-T-A, republicofkanata.ca. And I want to just start a quote before I bring my co-host, Deb Golding, on. Two very important quotes to keep in mind. Abraham Lincoln at the start of the American Civil War, and we are in a civil war, folks. The storm has erupted and it is upon us. And so in these times, we should utter nothing for which we would not willingly be responsible through time and eternity. And put another way, in the American Revolution, Thomas Paine said, if there is to be trouble, let it be in our time so that our children may be free. And that's how I'm looking at it today, folks. Welcome to the show. And welcome, Deb, my co-host.
Thank you, Kevin. Thanks. It's great to be here. Thanks for having me on again. I enjoy this.
Well, it's especially important now that, you know, I was going to remind folks of, you know, I mentioned these other people in various countries that are acting on our work, our common law training manual. But at home, it's really exciting because there have been a number of new assemblies, common law assemblies formed across Canada the last little while. And one of them on Vancouver Island is actually tomorrow night, they're forming a common law court. And one of the things that's very exciting is a court order came out of the International Common Law Court of Justice in Brussels this last week. This is the same court that prosecuted and forced from office Pope Benedict in 2013. And it's like a template. Let me just read it. It's an order abolishing COVID restrictions and other unlawful measures. It's declared by the court that the statutory regulations that restrict free movement and association, impose mandatory quarantines and distancing, and require the wearing of masks are unlawful, unwarranted, and medically unsound measures that violate the fundamental liberties and security of the people. Therefore, it is ordered by the court that these measures have no authority and are declared to be null and void, and that no one is obligated or required to comply with the said measures. It's further ordered by the court that anyone who attempts to enforce these unlawful measures on others is violating this court order and is engaged in a criminal conspiracy against the liberty and well-being of the people, and as one engaged in a crime is subject to penalties and imprisonment upon conviction. Now, I have a copy of this. It's signed by the presiding magistrate, Eloise Comrie Dufour, of the International Common Law Court of Justice in Brussels. Now, this is going to be sent out, and it's used as a tool anywhere, along with local common law court orders that can be issued by our assemblies. You hand it to the police, to the medical people, to anyone who insists that you distance or wear a mask. You hand it to them and say, guess what, people? You are guilty of a crime by trying to force this on us. We've turned the tables on them. Now you can be brought into our courts for trial and conviction. So I think this is very exciting. It's a way to arm people with something they can do. We're not simply on the defensive anymore. We're taking the fight to them. Any thoughts,
wow,
Deb?
What a powerful statement. The thing that's the verbiage really is definitely powerful, but what is even more empowering is because it's a common law court and it can be a template, this is a global thing. It's not just for Brussels, and you don't have to, you know, change it a little bit and word it differently for Canada or for the United States or for Africa or whatever. I mean, common law is human. That is just as human rights. It's just something that people can say, wow, I have this availability myself. And so it would be really encouraging for people to listen to that and say, you know what, I think I want to do the same thing. How do I go about creating a court, a common law court in my area? Right. And what you've been doing, you know, has been actually helping those assemblies, doing some advising, traveling to different places, and doing the workshops that you've been doing. So I've got a question for you. It's been 5 months since the March restrictions have been, you know, globally applied, and you have been doing some, active work here. So what are some of the things that you've noticed as you've been doing these workshops that you've been involved in? Like, what are the lessons that you're gleaning from this now?
Well, good question. And I've been reflecting on that a lot. And it's really important to share these lessons. That's, you know, when you're part of a movement, you get feedback, you see what works and what doesn't. And I can tell you right off, the idea of the assembly is what we aim for. It's the ultimate goal. And what your experience on the ground in many places has been is that if you get a lot of people together right now, they tend to start venting a lot naturally. I mean, there's a wonderful energy in these assemblies because people say, I hear this time and again, they say, I feel so free being here. I can touch people. I can hug them. I can shake hands. I can get out from this tyranny, mental tyranny we're under all the time. So that in itself is wonderful, and we've got to keep that going. On the other hand, the downside is that people need to talk, and they talk, and they talk, and they talk, and they vent about all the latest stuff they've read. And mm-hmm. not a lot of it really gets done. And what we found is necessary to do is to do the practical day-to-day work. You've got to get it organized in a smaller, tighter group. That's sometimes in the steering committee. Sometimes it's just people saying, okay, let's take actions. Let's plan certain actions. One thing we need to and do set up right away is an urgent response network of 5 or 10 people who are able to be mobilized on 15 minutes notice in case one of us gets attacked. They can be there at their side with cameras, with ways of support, and back down the police or the other people. It's already begun to work. And so that's kind of a practical thing people need to do as part of the organizing in the sheriff's department. But, you know, we find that unless you anchor people's enthusiasm into an immediate way to be active, it just hangs there at the level of talk. And after a few weeks of just talking, people drift away. They say, well, this is just another thing like we get on the internet, more talk, but what are we going to actually do, especially since our children might be getting locked up in 3 weeks in the school system. And that's just not an idle threat. It is going to happen. So it's that combination of giving people a chance to speak, but then anchoring it in some way that they can be active. And one of the ways we do that isn't just through the assembly, which, say, can meet every few weeks, for everyone in the community, but the actual what we call sovereignty cells of 3 to 5 people who say, okay, here's an action we're going to do, we're just going to go do it, and then we'll bring the results back to the assembly. So, I mean, that's one of the lessons that stands out right away.
Wow, that's actually really, that's impressive, because I know that it would, at least for me, it would be really important and powerful to know that as I am taking responsibility and doing my own action steps, that I had a community that I could fall back on that have actually committed to being active in, hey, if you need some help, I'm there. Or if I get to actually step into that role and say, you know what, if anything happens, I will be there. That's so powerful, especially right now with what it is that we're looking at. We're looking at action. So what I heard you say was people love to talk, which is such a human situation anyway. But having that action to actually step into an action space itself, for coming from responsibility, coming from actually a defiant stance, that is empowering, you know? And I love that. Well, so that's my next question. Go ahead.
Well, we'll get to that, but here's a kind of corollary to that is when you get 10 people in a room, you get 10 opinions, and there's no basis of unity necessarily. 10 different, especially when we're flooded with so much information, and I would say most of it's fog and distraction on the internet. We go from what we know from our life experience and what we see around us. But when you get 10 people all talking, you get 10 opinions. But when you all do something together, you have a common experience, and then you're able to find a basis of unity. So that's why we say unity is found in action, not in discussion. And example of that, the other day, they've just formed a common law assembly in Victoria, which is the capital of British Columbia. It's on the southern tip of Vancouver Island. And the way it came about, a group of people stood there in front of the legislature every Saturday with signs demanding an end to the restrictions. And they took the next step after one of our organizers went there and said, okay, let's sign the charter. Let's take this to another level. But they were united because they had that common action every day and or every Saturday. And they could compare notes. They could say, oh, yeah, remember when this guy yelled at us and we had a conversation, we actually won him over. And when we talked to the police about it, like they all had that experience together. So the experience is invaluable. There's no substitute for it. And but at the same time, I don't want to kind of downplay the value of education and knowing our enemy and knowing ourselves. Mm-hmm. And I want to get into that, but I know you had another question.
Well, I was actually just going to ask you about that. I was wanting to know that a little bit more about that. But as we're talking about application here, you know, what has worked? What's not worked? What would you say are the do's and don'ts of this this experience that you're noticing that you know about, and maybe where you're going is going to actually answer that question too. So yeah, by all means, let's dive in.
Oh, well, I mean, basic do's and don'ts. I mean, you know, if we're talking about action, it's a lot of it's common sense. In fact, I would refer people to a manual for whistleblowers and hellraisers, which is what I mentioned early in the show, because, and all of these books you can get it, unfortunately, at Amazon, but you can order them as well through us. In that, you know, it says the value of common sense is that you know intuitively, instinctively what to do. For example, if you have an inner circle of people that are meeting to plan things, you don't invite newcomers into the inner circle. You have an outer circle to which you invite anyone who writes you and shows interest. You use the outer circle of the assembly to introduce people to the group, to the ideas, to kind of weed people out, recruit them into the inner circle and the inner committees. But you don't mix it all together. I remember one assembly tried that, and there was a faction in the assembly that said, no, we've got to keep everything open at all times for everybody. Well, they are quickly falling apart because they don't know who is coming in. They have no way to screen people. There's been several people who show up and just argue and disrupt all the time. And so there's no way to get anything done. So you've got to be very selective in who you invite into the, you know, the more committed activity, because people come and go. Some people aren't as committed as others, but you've got to find that minority. Like Sun Tzu, we've talked about this before in The Art of War. Sun Tzu says battles are not won by a majority, but by a minority of seasoned veterans. And those are the ones we look to and organize. The people who have already been taking action, who already have their own experiences. So I think that's a definite do and don't.
So that actually just builds on what you've been saying then, actually. So you've got this experience that you come together, have a common experience, and from that common experience, then it becomes easier for that cell to actually be those veterans, those experienced ones that can have that inner cell and or inner circle, which can actually have an outer circle. And that training gets to be really, really thorough, and then more common experiences happen. And I like that. But I'm curious about demonstrations. Like, there's a lot of demonstrations going on. You said that you just attended one too.
Yeah.
So let's talk about that for a minute. It's like, I know they're good. But I know that you and I, as we've been talking about that, you know, the question that you've posed is demonstrations are great, but who are they speaking to? So that's part of also that seasoned veteran training, that if you just show up and you're kind of new at doing this, you know, what is it that in that demonstration, that, you know, not just what are you trying to do, but who are you speaking to? So, you know, tell us a little bit about what you've noticed of demonstrations.
Well, it's kind of like learned behavior. Habitual behavior, right? Like the way we eat, we kind of automatically eat. We think that way too. We think according to habit. And people think, oh, if you're against something, you should pick up a sign and protest. That's a learned behavior, because from a time when if you put pressure on government, they might respond in some way. So, but Sun Tzu warns against that. He says, you're giving away your chi or your essential energy by asking something from somebody in authority. No matter how militant the protest, you're still expecting the system to respond to you, and you're immobilized if they don't respond. You're just left hanging there. Mm-hmm. Remember, I've seen this so many times. Tens of thousands of people protesting in the nation's capital. Nothing happens. They all fall away. I remember back, an amazing example of this, when I was in my 20s. In British Columbia, there was a general strike in 1983. The whole province was shut down because the government was bringing in legislation to abolish human rights laws, sack a quarter of the civil service. I mean, it was really bad. And so at one point, I was in a demonstration of 80,000 people in downtown Vancouver. Wow. It was incredible energy. We felt we could take over the world, literally. We filled up the city of Vancouver, like, for blocks and blocks. You couldn't see the end of the protest. And everyone said, look, wow, we're changing the world. There's all of us people doing this. Two leaders of the what's called Operation Solidarity, two labor leaders, sat down and sold everything out. They settled for minimal, and they told everybody to go home. And the amazing thing was, everybody went home. And it was such a defeat. But the reason it was defeated, not because those bureaucrats did what they did, because that's what they do, right? People in those positions compromise and sell out. I mean, we've all had experience with that. But why did those 80,000 people just go home? Why didn't they just stay in the streets and say, screw you, and more importantly, stop paying the taxes and take back the government, create these assemblies that we're talking about now, which you've forced to do because their backs are to the wall. If those people had done that, the whole society would have changed, but they learned to listen to somebody in authority, so they went home. And that's our real downfall. The problem is our thinking and not necessarily the people who we look to, because, I mean, they're doing what they do, right? Right. Don't trust them. Don't even pay any attention to them. Look to us. And, it's that famous saying from Sun Tzu where he says, if you know your enemy and you know yourself, you don't have to fear the result of any battle. You have to know yourself and know your enemy. But unfortunately, we don't know either right now. We're going from hearsay. We're going from all sorts of theories about who the enemy is. We're not going from our own experience, what we know from our life. And we don't know ourselves well enough because most of us, when we're asked to do something, we back off in fear. Why is that? Do we know ourselves well enough to get engaged? So it's all part of the same process, right? The same struggle.
Right. So it sounds like we've got to do something different. And this is part of what this particular show is about and what your mission is. And, well, a collective mission is just to give some other solutions to do something different. But I also know, I mean, you just led right into this really well about knowing yourself. Like, look at your own actions and what you're driven to do, what you feel inspired to do. One of the things that's so beautiful in my mind about being a human is that we look for meaning, you know, so we want to have things be meaningful to us so that we can actually, you know, take control of what the situation is. But gosh, you know, looking at the situation that we are in right now, how confusing this is. Like, we keep getting confused about what's allowed, what's not allowed, using that word specifically, you know, what do we do next? If you can give meaning to something, you and I were talking about this earlier, then you can actually kind of anchor into the reason for your own, you know, action. But if you can't give reason to it, if you can't really understand the meaning because you're so confused, which I'm telling you is really a big part of my experience with the conditioning and the control and the programming and the torture that I went through, I lived in confusion. Even during my waking hours, there were things that were going on. I just, kind of on marshy ground. There was nothing really stable to anchor into. Even what I thought was stable wasn't. So this is the same mind control that was really focused on me. Is the application is happening worldwide for this confusing thing. So that humans, because human beings love this, giving meaning to things that you can't get into this, and so this cognitive dissonance happens.
I'm so glad you raised that. Deb, because I know your whole history that we've talked about on previous shows in the Mormon Church and being, you know, ritually tortured and all of that stuff, you've had, and to survive that and to be as clear and strong as you are invaluable in terms of survivors and all of us, because those same methods perfected in those torture sessions, which had military and government backing behind it, they've learned from that how to control people's psyches, and we have to understand what they learned to counter it. And one of the perfect examples of what you're talking about, this woman, her name is Bonnie Henry. She's the head self-appointed health officer for all of British Columbia. And she came out 2 days ago and said, well, you know, masks don't really help. From a medical point of view, they're not really efficacious. And yet, at the same day, they announced that now masking will be extended and be made mandatory everywhere. So you see, that's a deliberate psyop right there, psychological warfare. Mm-hmm. They're telling you one thing and doing another. They're saying it doesn't work, but you have to do it. And that doesn't make any sense to common reason. So they deliberately confuse reason and meaning, and the person doesn't know what to believe, and so they do what they're told. And
right.
Classic torture techniques. They do it in bad cop, soft cop sessions. I've experienced that when I've been imprisoned and interrogated. Bad cop, soft cop. Give you a little bit of hope, take it away. Bit of hope, take it away. That's how you break people down psychologically. So let's really be clear. We're all being subjected to psychological warfare at every moment, and we need to counter it with this kind of knowledge.
Man, I'll tell you, it is 100% that. It is 100% the hope, take it away, hope, take it away. If you do this enough, like you said, it breaks a person down. And if when it's thorough enough, and I'll tell you, like you said, this is an unending situation where there's something new that's coming out every day. You're hearing this report. You're seeing this action. It is so thorough. That was my experience within these torture incidents. I mean, honestly, all the time there was hope, and I just grabbed for that hope. It's ripped away, and then pretty soon you just kind of get lethargic. You just give up, and that giving up really opens you up to that. It's kind of like your whole mind opens up like a funnel, and it's just now we can dump in whatever we want. So it's part of this fracturing of the mind, and so here we can look at this on a global scale and say, look, we are being fractured not only as individuals but as communities, but as states, as nations, as country against country, all of this stuff, and again, divide and conquer. But that, this kind of talk, it is talk about war. It is a strategist kind of talk. And so if, you know, when you've said before, we are at war, this is a psychological warfare situation, I think, I don't know if people really catch on to how real that is. I mean, we're not going to be, it's coming at us differently, and we have been eased into this. Like, we have been massaged into this, and they're giving out all kinds of, like, I'm just thinking of cell phones and other devices that kind of funnel us down a particular way, and we're kind of used to the authority, quote unquote, telling us what the next upgrade is, or what the next app is, what the thing that we want next. And so that is one way that we've really been conditioned. And so now, when this terrorist of this virus, or name a terrorist, it's just going to come in. They're going to name another one. It's you know, if they can move it away from a health issue, they will. But I think you and I were talking about how genocide is always based on health measures. And you are
right.
You have got 25 plus years of this, of experience here. And I would love for you to touch on, actually just kind of create the, how is this, what's going on now? What it is like, what your experience has been, and a historic reference of what it's been with the Indian children that you've been working with, and also with what's
that's the thing.
Compared to now.
You said genocide is public health knowledge, and that's language, and that's exactly what it is. There's examples all through history. You know, Nazism, in its early stage, it was described as really a public health movement. There's certain vermin in society that are polluting our Aryan culture, and they have to be removed. And they were public health laws allowing sterilizations. There's a great book by Edwin Black called War Against the Weak, how the eugenics movement to wipe out whole groups of people actually began in the United States in the 1880s in the medical community. And they said certain people are polluting the culture, the mentally defective, foreigners, immigrants, aboriginal people, criminals. And these people need to be sterilized so they don't propagate for reasons of public health. And, you know, genocide in Canada, same thing. And if you read in the same period of time, there's letters sent to the federal government by church groups saying the Indians are intermarrying and intermingling with our race, and they're spreading TB among us, when in fact it was the other way around. We disseminated TB to them. But the point is that as a result, right after that, the first Indian hospitals and residential schools were set up as a public health measure. And so once again, it's being done to all of us, or we're allowing this to be done to us, under the guise of paranoia and fear about our health. And it works really well because, you know, another example, I'm standing in just photocopying the other day, and a young girl has a mask on. I'm well away from her, but I lean over to look out the window, and she starts in on me about how I'm irresponsible and horrible, and I don't mind if people die. I turned to her, and I said, young lady, I am not in your psychosis. You need to start thinking for yourself, because blind obedience to anybody is going to get you killed. And she was shocked. She didn't know what to say to that, mm-hmm. right? But maybe it planted a few seeds. But it's all about, we don't want to get sick, right? And that's definitely part of it. And, you know, you see it around us every day.
Absolutely. Well, it's appealing to, you know, again, the base desire or need that we have, which is to live. Like, I've been reading Viktor Frankl's book about, you know, the man's search for meaning, and just even being in a concentration camp and how there's resilience, levels of resilience there. And you could tell when somebody really gave up all their hope, it, just by simple little things, they knew it wasn't long before they died. And that's really what there is this propensity towards death kind of throws reason out the window. I mean, it's really kind of, it's one of those things that can be really empowering yeah. where you're just like, I will stand here and I will defend myself, my family, I will all these rights. Or
yes.
if you feel like it's coming at you kind of as a curveball, you can get distracted and just kind of get scattered. Like, you know, where are we in our responsibility of what's in front of us?
Right, responsibility, that's the key word. And before we go to the break, and we've got a really neat clip from Patrick Henry's speech, Give Me Liberty, Give Me Death. It's so relevant, and I want to urge people to listen in on this. But just before I get to that, you talked about death. Now, we had a report from a nurse, and I won't say where because her job is on the line, but she said old people in her facility in this care home are dying every day because their family are not allowed in to see them. And when you're 85 and your only link is your family and your memories and the support and love you get from them, and you cut that off, they die. They said people have been dying from grief, and she's charging Bonnie Henry, the health minister, not health minister, but health bureaucrat, with murder. And, you know, we can talk more about this after the break, but people are being killed as we speak by this, not by some phony virus, but by these measures. And that's the context we're putting all this all in. And in that light, I wanted to go now and listen to Patrick Henry and be inspired by his words 250 years ago, but they're still relevant today. Patrick Henry.
Thing that could be done to avert the storm that is now coming on. We have petitioned. We have remonstrated. We have supplicated. We have prostrated ourselves before the throne and implored its interposition to arrest the tyrannical hands of the ministry and parliament. Our petitions have been slighted. Our remonstrances have produced additional violence and insult. Our supplications have been disregarded, and we have been spurned with contempt from the foot of the throne. In vain, after these things, may we indulge the fond hope of peace and reconciliation. There is no longer any room for peace. If we wish to be free, if we mean to hold inviolate those inestimable privileges for which we have been so long contending, if we mean not basely to abandon the noble struggle in which we have been so long engaged and which we have pledged ourselves never to abandon until the glorious object of our contest shall be obtained, we must fight. I repeat it, sir. We must fight. An appeal to arms and to the God of hosts is all that is left us. They say, sir, that we are weak and able to cope with so formidable an adversary. But when shall we be stronger? Will it be the next week or the next year? Will it be when we are totally disarmed and a British guard shall be stationed in every house? Shall we acquire the means of effectual resistance by lying supinely on our backs and hugging the delusive phantom of hope until our enemy shall have bound us hand and foot? Sir, we are not weak. If we make a proper use of those means which the God of nature hath placed in our power, the millions of people armed in the holy cause of liberty, and in such a country as that which we possess, are invincible by any force which our enemy can send against us. Besides, sir, we shall not fight our battles alone. There is a just God who presides over the destinies of nations and who will raise up friends to fight our battles before us. The battle, sir, is not to the strong alone. It is to the vigilant, the active, the brave. Besides, sir, we have no election. If we were base enough to desire it, it is now too late to retire from the contest. There is no retreat but in submission and slavery. Our chains are forged. Their clanking may be heard on the plains of Boston. The war is inevitable, and let it come. I repeat it, sir, let it come. It is in vain, sir, to extenuate the matter. Gentlemen may cry, peace, peace. There is no peace. The war is actually begun. The next gale that sweeps from the north will bring to our ears the clash of resounding arms. Our brethren are already in the field. Why stand we here idle? What is it that gentlemen wish? What would they have? Is life so dear, or peace so sweet, as to be purchased at the price of chains and slavery? Forbid it, Almighty God! I know not what course others may take, but as for me, give me liberty or give me death!
Patrick Henry, one of our ancestors. I'm in tears, people.
Oh my.
Yes, it's, we have to dwell long on that spirit and those words because that is our situation now. And, you know, victory doesn't belong to the strong. It belongs to the determined, right? And we are, right?
Vigilant and the brave, absolutely. Like being really invested in what that means to you. You know, when you're referring to being at war and listening to Patrick Henry's words, we think differently in war than we do in peace. You know, yeah. And the terms, when you can put yourself in a place where, if you want to imagine being in the audience and listening to that, what does that do to you personally? What embers suddenly burst into flame, and what do you want to hold on to, you know, in that moment? Can we be more vigilant in discernment, in seeing what's in front of us? Health measures. I'm going to go back to that quote-unquote health measures. Well, we're assuming, because we want to, because we kind of think that, you know, they who are putting out health measures have our health in mind, but do they? Is that really the motivation? And are we going to rely on something outside of ourselves? Because honestly, if you're going to be thinking about it, you bring it down into something very, very personal, your own health. You are the most accurate barometer of your own health than anybody outside. Yep. You might need a few answers, but this is coming down to us. And if we turn that over, you know, then just even
we
that
survived,
need.
We survived millions of years without vaccines, without science, without anything. We are much stronger physically and mentally and spiritually than we ever realize until it's forced, right? Mm-hmm. And I've learned that. My life was destroyed, and I'm still here. Not because I'm Superman or special, but because I had everything stripped away until I found the part they couldn't take away. And we all need to go through that. And that's why this isn't right away for many people. But those of us who've been through that and are strong and see it have to lead the others. And that's, it's a great joy in doing that, to be able to trigger that in others. And I experienced that the other day. To be in a room of people who find hope again and want to fight, it's just, it's like just this huge light breaks out among all of us. And all of their lies and all of the crap just fades away. And that's what we have to light, like Samuel Adams said, we have to light 100 brush fires of freedom in the minds of men and women. It doesn't take many to do that, but we have to. That's our job now.
You know, when you're talking about how being in a room of hope, just it's infectious, right? You can be in there, and there is, it's intrinsic in every single human to understand what's going on there. And we give it words, we give it names, but boy, when you're in that energy, that I would say is definitely something to keep reflecting back onto, those times, those moments, those events where hope is inspired, where you're hearing something that is really just, that kindles that brush fire, right, inside of each of us, because it is our own responsibility. And then in that responsibility, just taking that responsibility and looking at it inward, right, looking how it hits you inside, and then how you can inspire that outside. And sometimes it's not even the how, it's just being that example. It's just doing and acting that, again, lights somebody else, ignites that other fire, too. I'd like to go back, though, if you could give us more examples about the genocide and the public health measures and, you know, where you wanted to take that, because this is really important. This is the same tactic that was being used so many other times. I mean, like you're saying, you gave some historic references. So what can we see and what can we learn from this?
Well, I think the learning is obvious to anyone who reads it. I mean, it's all been out there for years now. Murderbydecree.com. You go there and you look at the methods used on Indians and still used today under the Indian Act. Mandatory vaccinations have been the case for Indians on reservations in North America since 1874, and the Indian Act and similar acts in America, right? You cannot, to this day, you're living on reservation, you cannot stop a health nurse from coming in and shoving a needle in your child's arm or taking them away for good and you never see them again. That's the reality that many people around us live through, and yet it's not anything new. That's the point. There's nothing new under the sun except what we didn't know about, right? And including not just the history, but what's going on to our neighbors right now as we speak. And so it's not a matter anymore of thinking about our individual health, because like, It's almost a point now in the earth, and this is why I think people are so obsessed about health. We understand the toxic shit we're living in, electromagnetically, chemically, radiation. We are dying, and we're not going to solve that by creating more of a condition of dictatorship to allow the people who've caused that dying to be in absolute control, right? And, you know, it's,
absolutely,
the corporatocracy that's now taking over is going to ensure the final ruination of our planet, and maybe that's, you know, people have speculated about that, you know, why the microchipping, why this, but we're not here to speculate. We're here to act on what we know. And that's, trying to stimulate that in people is kind of difficult, because they're always looking to somebody else and some other issue. And I have to say to people, first thing you got to do, turn off your internet. You're not going to learn anything there that you don't already know. Okay. You'll learn more of the details and claims and suppositions. And it's a lot easier to sit on your ass and just listen to somebody else. But it doesn't get anything done, and it doesn't improve you at all. It's just a lot of baffle gab. And we found that in some of the assemblies. They said, one of the women the other day said, I'm trying to organize some action groups, and all I keep getting from people is the latest email on some other issue. And I've had to say to them, stop sending me this stuff. We want to talk about now. What are we going to do next week or in 2 weeks when they start seizing our children? Well, how are we going to defend people? How are we going to educate people? If people aren't concerned about that now, forget it. We might as well not do any of this. So everything's got to be geared to using that understanding of what they've done up till now to what we're going to do now to end it. And frankly, you know, Deb, this is why we had to declare the Republic, because I'm not going to be part of a culture anymore that did this to children. There's no way I am ever, ever going to be part of Canada again. That's why I am committed to the death to this Republic, because it's the only chance for any of us. And the same is true in America. The same is true anywhere.
That's inspiring too, right there. Because what you're bringing into focus here, just even by looking at in 2 to 3 weeks, the possibility or the certainty, give it some time, of children being quarantined within the schools, and how they're building that, you know, that infrastructure so that the kids can stay there, and, you know, parents can't get them out without the injections that are supposed to be there for them. It's something that could be really deflating. Like, if you're one of those parents and you want to get one of your children, and it's just so easy to back up and just kind of say, I don't know what to do, and I anything for my child, and that anything for my child statement can take you one of two ways. You can kind of feel deflated by it, or you can actually say, no, we're going to do something different here.
That's the question. And the unfortunate reality, Deb, is that's not the question in people's minds. They don't care about their children as much as what might happen to them if they disobey authority. That's the unfortunate reality with a big number of people, that they would rather allow their children to go through that hell than to risk confronting authority. And that's just the way people have been programmed. The basic instinct of self-preservation that you see in animals, die to protect their young, that's being conditioned out of a lot of people so that they would, and look at our campaign about murdered children. We would be lucky to get 10 or 20 people to a protest. Thousands of people on the streets over other issues, but about murdered children, forget it. And that's because we have been changed. We have been warped. We've had battered out of us the inherent need to protect children to the death, right? What happened to that? And unfortunately, we have to recognize that before we can take this on, because if we don't, we're trying to build on sand. And we've got to say to people right away with flyers, we're doing a special flyer today we can send out to anybody. If anybody wants a copy of this, write to republicofcanada@gmail.com. But this flyer is saying to parents everywhere, put it in mailboxes, put it everywhere. It says, boycott the schools, do not put your children in schools, do not register them in daycares or schools, keep them at home. Because if you don't, you might not see them again, ever. And you might not see yourself ever again either.
Well, this kind of goes right back to what you were talking about before. Yeah. This is, why is it important to know thyself? Why is that so critical, especially in the context of what Sun Tzu is saying? You know, why is it so critical to know thyself? What would you do faced in this situation? Knowing who you are and what you would do in this situation is going to give you some clues, and you might shock yourself. You might find that, you know, you are really ready to take your sword and go to arms, or you might find yourself going, well, I don't know. I mean, I've got to go to work, and if I keep my kid at home, you know, that was a nightmare before because of all the homeschooling. And, you know, I mean, you could give yourself all of these reasons to not do that. But you could also give yourself reasons to say, well, honestly, this whole thing is changing, and I'm being forced into a change here. So what do I get to do about this? So referring back to you, why is it important to know thyself?
I don't want to underestimate the people who have said, I will fight to the death and I will go in and get the children out with a gun if I have to, if they try doing that to them. I've met people like that. But, you know, we have to recognize that it's not only an uphill battle, but it's going against every impulse and idea that everyone's ever been raised with, right? Mm-hmm. And especially in Canada, we're being raised with the idea that the state is benevolent, the state will take care of you if you obey the rules. And it's such a lie. It's always been a lie, but it's an obvious lie now. And people have to be armed on that basis. So on that, in the last, we've got about 12 minutes or 15, something like that left, under 15 minutes left. I wanted to remind people of a few things, that there is, even if you don't have an assembly in your area, there are people all over the place who are part of this movement. And there's material we can send you. You can see on our new website, Republic of Canada, K-A-N-A-T-A, republicofcanada.ca, a lot of resources to use to start the process in your community. And it's important to stay in touch at republicofcanada@gmail.com because we're coordinating the efforts. The other day, some people in Saskatchewan said, I don't know anyone. What can you do to help us? We instantly connected with people nearby who were able to go there and actually organize urgent response network so that those people now have some people to rely on when they make the decision to fight the system. So communicating with each other is really important. And also armed with knowledge, I really want to urge people, and this is the two manuals, the common law training manual and the whistleblower manual, are like literally selling like hotcakes. There's hundreds of them that are being grabbed up these days. I keep selling out all the copies I have and have to order new ones. And so it's a very important training guide to organize a group based on that. And like I said, they're already translating it into six other languages and using it. So we got to really emphasize education. I know we've been talking a lot about action, but it's got to be informed action. And, you know, that's one thing I wanted to plug before the time ran out. I love this quote too. If you give a slave a right to vote, they'll simply ratify their own slavery. And it's not just about democracy, but you have to get the slaves to liberate themselves before they can be part of a responsible system of government. And it isn't that you educate and then they liberate. Often it's the other way around. You know, the old saying, people don't make revolutions, revolutions make them. Because in the course of resisting and revolting, you learn. You learn a lot about the system and yourself. And you start out with one objective and you end up something much more unexpected, right? I mean, the American Civil War began not about slavery, and it ended about slavery. It ended because Lincoln had to take that measure as a war measure. And one day people realized, yeah, this is about abolishing slavery and of all sorts. And it evolves. We all evolve that way in the course of a struggle, but you've got to be engaged in the struggle. And that's what I think is part of the lesson of today, right? This show today.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Well, and that I'm really glad that you brought up the books too, because when it is, you know, when it is our responsibility, and since it is our responsibility to take action, educating yourself, being really educated in and helping yourself with that action is so important. I mean, because what do? When people come up to you and you say, all right, so we've got to think in terms of action, and the next comment is, well, what do we do? You know, we've got to do something. Well, what do we do? That question, I think every one of us can relate to, but when you're educated, definitely with these manuals, I would say that's a great place to start. And then getting educated, you know, in your community specifically, because these cells are so important, and that's where you're going to start them in your own community. Educate yourself.
But, you know,
and step into that.
Community organizing 101, you know, one of the basic principles of organizing the community is when somebody asks you a question, you ask a question back. You use the Socratic method, and they say, what can we do? I say to them, well, what, I don't know, what can we do? What do you think we can do? What do you feel capable of doing, and what are you not capable of doing? And then you get right into it. You get into people's psyche and their limitations, and it's a question-answer, call-response kind of process. It isn't the expert coming in with the answer. It's people finding the answer that's already within themselves, and one of the ways that happens best, they say, you know, getting hit on the head by a cop is better education than 100 hours of lectures, right?
What that's doing, in essence, is it is actually creating a whole different form of responsibility. So, I mean, we're talking about the corporatocracy, you know, where the rule is by decree and it's a vertical control, and we expect somebody above us to solve the problem, or we're going to elect an official, or we're going to go up, and expect that is going to be for our community's best good, versus what you're talking about here. When you start saying, what do you feel capable of doing? What feels real to you right now? That moves it horizontal. That spreads it out. That gives it a wide swath, because really, if all you ever feel capable of doing in that moment is writing emails or distributing, you know, leaflets to mailboxes or whatever, that matters. That matters.
Yep.
Having a conversation or opening your home to having a group, all of this matters, and it's doable. It doesn't mean you need to go, you know, like organize a 5,000 people protest, but if you feel called to do so, that matters. So again, knowing yourself.
Yep. Very important. And, you know, it's also like when you show up with a group of people and, you know, one of the first things you say all the time is, people say, well, are we able to do this? Like they ask the question back to me all the time. And they're looking to me for an answer. And by looking to me, what they're really saying is, I want to avoid responsibility here. I want you to take the responsibility. So if it fails, it's on your shoulders, not mine, and I don't have to risk. That's kind of a natural first stage human response. And what I gently do with people is to lead them into an experience somehow. And they can see for themselves that they are able to respond. They are capable of being responsible and to take responsibility for doing something, whatever it is. Because then you have an experience and you bring it back to the group and you talk about it. But if you're going to just... and if you're going to talk all day, anything can be true. That's the terrible aspect of the internet, is that it gives, everything seems true. Anything can be real. So nothing is real, right? It's like when you say to everybody, I love you. Well, what does that mean? Do you really love them? Or is it just a cliche, right? Anything can be true. Nothing is true. And so we have to know our own truth in yourself. And you're not going to get that externally through somebody else or through the internet. You're going to get it from your own heart once you realize that you're pushed to the wall. And it's life and death now, and that's our situation right now.
Well, what I really like that you just said here is that those that are listening to this program really are the ones that are in a space where they can be a leader and do exactly, like, kind of take from your example there, because we have to be kind of aware of our own selves if we want to fix something or take charge of something, showing up with the answer versus doing what you just said. It's like, how about we lead them into an experience? Because then that goes right back to what we were talking about earlier, that when you have experience, you create unity. That respect of somebody saying, you know, I don't know, let's discuss this, or and seeing what you can see to lead them into another experience, that empowers them. That also creates more of a broad responsibility, and then people feel capable. Right. So I'm really glad that you brought up that what you do in those situations, because those that are listening will be in those situations. I guarantee you.
Right. And Deb, we've got 2 minutes left, and I want to just once again thank you for being on and having a great dialogue again. And
thanks.
For people wanting to go further, if you go to republicofcanada.ca under upcoming events, you'll notice public events being planned in Ontario in September, but there's a lot more that haven't been posted yet. Sometimes people don't want them posted. They're still in the organizing stage. You know, for security reasons, they want to let that left off. But keep in mind that now and during September, there's going to be a lot of action on the ground. And you have to reach out and become part of that. republicofcanada@gmail.com. In the coming weeks, we're going to be taking the workshops we do on common law in the Republic and bringing them on the air, so that concrete issues that you've had, questions you want answered about the common law and how we act, we're going to answer them. We're going to have a dialogue over the air about all of that based on the feedback we're getting. And we've been getting emails today from a lot of you saying, what about this? What about that? We'll address those in the coming weeks. But also, like I say, republicofcanada@gmail.com. And you can write to me personally at angelfire101@protonmail.com. And again, I want to thank you all for tuning in. We're going to carry this on, especially in the coming essential weeks, where we're going to lead a whole campaign to defend our children. We're going to end with a really inspiring song. It's from the period of the Italian resistance during World War II. It was a song of the Italian resistance. It's called Bella Ciao. And it's updated, but it's very relevant again. Like Patrick Henry's words today, to keep us going in this fight, brothers and sisters, the love we share, the determination we have to end this beast once and for all and uphold our sacred liberties and the lives of our children, that's a sacred cause, and we're never going to stop. Even if they kill us tomorrow, it'll carry on. Believe that, carry it on, stay strong and stay clear. We're back next week. Thank you.